Welcome to The Motivated Mind, where I challenge you to expand your perspective on how to achieve a successful life through motivational lessons, reflections, and interviews with other motivated minds. Welcome back to The Motivated Mind, a top 100 health podcast, thanks to each of you. This is episode 402, and I'm your host, Scott Lynch. If I've brought you any value, please be sure to leave a review, hit that subscribe or follow button, and please be sure to share the podcast. Thanks for making The Motivated Mind part of your story. Today we have another special guest that joins the pod, Dr. Cam Seppa. He's a clinical psychologist and professor of psychiatry turned entrepreneur and investor. He's also an expert in mind-body medicine and pioneered the field of digital therapeutics as founding medical director of Omada Health and has invested in consumer and health tech companies at Trinity Ventures and his own fund, Maggie Ventures. He continues to work with top CEOs, VCs, and professional athletes on optimizing their health and performance and has made the tools used in his practice accessible to millions via Maximus. As CEO of Maximus, he fulfills his mission to help men become better in body and mind using evidence-based medicine. Dr. Cam has spent years researching and developing cutting-edge treatments that are safe and effective for optimizing health and performance. Coupled with content, community, and coaching, Maximus provides powerful and effective protocols to maximize men's hormones and holistic health. Dr. Cam and I dive into how the medical field's fragmented stance has fostered misinformation, polarized views, and oversimplified perspectives among influencers fueled by sensationalism, the exploitation of credentials by leading health influencers, and its repercussions on the average consumer. Utilizing the null hypothesis approach when engaging with various content, particularly in the medical field, how willpower doesn't tend to domain transfer very well, the importance of psychological flexibility, the five foundational health behaviors, and finally, the importance of dopamine fasting and how doom scrolling will become the new smoking. I hope you all enjoy our conversation. Having spent over a decade in the cannabis industry, I've witnessed many consumers, myself included, grappling with the overwhelming abundance of options and information available, especially when it comes to navigating the thousands of cannabis strains. It's like navigating a maze. And driven by this challenge, my team and I embarked on a journey 4 years ago to change this narrative. Our goal was to provide consumers with the data and education necessary to make informed decisions, enhance their cannabis experience, and ultimately improve their lives. Today, I'm grateful and happy to announce that we've launched HashDash, the world's first personalized cannabis matching platform that leverages over 637,000 cannabis strain data points to match you with your favorite cannabis that aligns with your unique preferences. Our platform centers around three key pillars: matching, community, and education. All three are aligned with our mission of empowering cannabis enthusiasts and newcomers alike, transforming confusion into clarity in the vast world of cannabis consumption. Say goodbye to the guesswork. Discover, learn, and elevate your cannabis experience with HashDash. Sign up for free at HashDash.com and find your cannabis match. That's HashDash.com. you challenging the noisy crowd. That's kind of your MO, and I love it. Maybe challenging the Brian Johnsons of the world. Let's put it that way. And again, I just want to cut through to the truth today, right? So where did that come from? You kind of sitting there and tossing your head like, oh my God. I know obviously your medical background, but taking a look at just this market, social media in general, and how many people have overcomplicated health, right? Where did it all go wrong?
That is a great question. And if you kind of get to the root cause of it, I honestly think that the medical establishment is to blame because they've created a vacuum of a lack of consensus and a lack of useful information for the average everyday Joe and Jane, right? If even the professionals, the professors, the medical societies cannot agree on what to eat, it creates a vacuum of information where I think an influencer can come in and say, I have the answer, just eat meat. I have the answer, just eat plants. And, you know, there is no ultimate truth. There is no consensus to fight against. And so I honestly think we've dropped the ball as medical professionals, and it's literally anonymous cartoon figures on social media have huge followings and huge influence, you know, and say ridiculous things like, you know, don't ever wear sunscreen because it's toxic. And, you know, the problem is there's hints of truth in those statements. There are, you know, sometimes endocrine disrupting chemicals in certain sunscreens. But does that mean you should never, ever wear a sunscreen? Does that mean you should actually get burned and clearly increase your risk of skin cancer? No, there's subtleties. There's obviously shades of gray in assessing whether something is healthy or not. But social media also as a platform doesn't allow for nuance, right? It likes sensationalism. And so when you have the foundation of a lack of consensus and clear information, it opportunistically allows influencers to come in with very strong points of view. Kind of my thesis around this is that when there's a lack of trust in institutions, the trust goes to individuals, right? These figureheads, these influencers, in terms of, you know, who sways public opinion. And then the platforms themselves are algorithmically designed to, you know, drive dopamine. And so the more outrageous, the more eccentric, the more, you know, honestly, it promotes a type of marketing that I call troll marketing. And Brian is actually, and his team, I would say, are geniuses at it, right? He had a tweet the other day, I injected my penis with Botox. And then, of course, it's going to get a million retweets because, you know, the only thing that's worse than being talked about, as Oscar Wilde said, is not being talked about. And he knows this. And the more crazy and outrageous the behavior, the more people talk about it. And it's going to obviously polarize and dissuade some people. But he actually has a decent following of people who, just by virtue of him being rich, think that he knows what he's doing, even though, you know, following a vegan diet, that's clearly not the case. But here we are, right, where celebrity is king and people love celebrity and will do anything that celebrities say because that's sort of the foundation of American culture.
Mm, there's a lot to unpack there. Let's start from the consumer side first. So I'm watching a video, I'm reading a newsletter, I'm, you know, reading through a tweet. What is my next step to ensure that the information is accurate? Because there's a lot of us that are headline readers, right? We see something, we hear that sensational hook at the beginning of a TikTok video, and we're pulled in. Being a thoughtful consumer, what's that next step to ensure that we aren't being pulled into that world?
I think the important thing to realize is it's very dangerous to use proxies for credibility. And that used to be a helpful thing. If one had an MD, a PhD, was a professor at a prestigious university, they often had credibility. In these days, though, there's been a strange shift from these folks who probably were credible at some point becoming celebrities, becoming social media influencers, and losing their credibility because of the inherent corrupting influence of social media. Dr. Oz, by the way, is the best example of this. He's a very legitimate cardiologist. And then he became a TV show host. And what's the problem when you're churning out five weekly midday television shows per day selling to a middle-aged female audience is you have to shill cactus weight burning, you know, blood body fat burning supplements and whatever the new interesting thing is. Because how many times can you say diet, exercise, sleep, and stress over and over and over again. It's not entertaining, right? You've become an entertainer. And so you have doctors who become clowns, essentially. And you see this, I would argue, the top health influencers right now essentially exploit their credentials. And the average like consumer is like, well, I don't know anything about health. This guy is a doctor. This guy is a professor. He must be legitimate. And I'm also a doctor professor, but I'm saying do not listen to me just because of my credentials, right? So I think people need to think for themselves. It is directionally, I would say, useful in that people who have more credentials or more institutional credibility are more likely, perhaps, to know what they're talking about. But it is zero guarantee in 2024 that is the case anymore, especially if they're making money off of their podcast. They're literally shilling ads at the beginning of their podcast, or the ad has essentially become a podcast. That's, by the way, my new thesis around this is the brilliance of these podcasts is before they used to be sponsored, there's an ad at the beginning or maybe interrupted at the middle. It's the commercial break. And everyone skips commercial breaks because they know it's an advertisement. But what's kind of brilliant is they've turned it on their heads and it's a health optimization podcast. And the entire podcast is the advertisement. They'll talk about, oh, take this supplement. And they happen to be an advisor for a supplement company in which they make their money. And they're shilling that stuff. And people are like, oh, let me write down, this is going to enhance my sleep or my stress. And so it's essentially an indirect ad. And so as opposed to skipping the ad, they're sitting there fast forwarding to minute 37 because, oh, this is the dosage of magnesium that Dr. blah, blah, blah recommends, right? So I think that's the tricky thing. And people are kind of conned into thinking, well, you know, this person's, you know, credible and objective when they're not. There's a clear conflict of interest. And there's nothing wrong with, by the way, making money. I'm a capitalist on your expertise or your opinions. But when it's, I think the difference is if someone has a foundational like salary from wherever else it is, and then they're sharing information, you know, to promote public health, that's less conflicted, I would say, versus when you're making money off the medium itself, the medium has to be sensational and get as many followers as possible. It's literally monetized and making money off of it. And so being boring is not going to sell.
You know, for me personally, that drives me crazy as a podcaster is when you watch these experts jump on other podcasts and they make everything seem like it's World War III if you don't change what you're doing. And it just so happens to be that they have a perfect solution fix for World War III. That's like, well, wait, as a consumer, as a listener, as a viewer, I then question the answers that you just provided the audience. Because if your goal is to convert listeners to customers, then one would assume that the information that you're telling me either is a little exaggerated or a lot exaggerated, or it's not as black and white as you make it out to be.
Right. Absolutely. And to answer your original question of where does skepticism come from, it comes from a couple places. So first, I'm a scientist, right? And the first thing they teach you in science is the null hypothesis. The default assumption is that the thing doesn't work. It's your burden to prove that it works, right? And so sometimes when I, you know, talk about, I'm not a fan of cold plunges and saunas and ice baths and all these things, they're like, well, what's the evidence against it? I'm like, no, what is the evidence for it? And how compelling and strong is that evidence, which is pretty weak, by the way. And so the thing that I would encourage everyone when answering your question about as a consumer, I'm on social media, is to have a healthy sense of skepticism. And if you don't rely on institutional credibility, then that means, okay, I got to examine, it's my responsibility as an informed consumer to examine the merits of it. Now, you may not be a scientist and it may be difficult for you to read a scientific paper, but I actually think it's really important for people to have a basic amount of scientific literacy and read primary sources, meaning the influencers are essentially the gatekeepers. They're saying, okay, let me interpret this for you because you're too dumb and this is too complex for you to figure out. But I've looked at all this literature and I'm the expert and let me communicate this to you. Now, there are good people who do that very well. They're translators of science, really excellent science writers. There are some very credible clinicians and scientists, but it's a grab bag. And so if you don't know who to trust, trust yourself, which is, okay, if someone's making a claim that this intervention is going to change your life, you're like, great, show me the studies. I'm not going to just listen to the podcast and assume just because you read the study, which, by the way, half these podcasters are not even reading the studies themselves. They have some grad student who's preparing it for them. they're like rat studies, or they're like studies of 10 people that are very poorly done from a methodological basis. And if you have a basic level of scientific credibility, you'd say, okay, I'm going to look up the citations that he's saying. I'm going to go read those studies. And you don't need to read them in depth, but basic literacy about, is this published in a good journal? What is the sample size? Does the methodology make sense? Anyone can be essentially a decent amateur scientist and scrutinize essentially data for themselves. And when you look at a lot of these studies, even if you glance at them from a cursory basis and say, oh, okay, like, I don't know, these ice bath studies are, you know, very terribly done. And are they really looking at anything that's a clinically meaningful outcome? Are you actually living longer? And same thing with these sauna studies. It's like, sure, it may reduce some cardiovascular risk, but is it any more than heating your body up when you exercise? You know, there's other ways of elevating body temperature. Do you need to sit in a sauna to do that? Just basic common sense and scrutiny, I think, will go a long way. But that's the number one thing I encourage people, is to read it, read the data for yourself rather than having someone be the mouthpiece for it, which, because of the biases, can be very skewed in promoting a certain type of, you know, practice. And there's an intrinsic bias that loses the scientific, you know, skepticism and scrutiny that most people, you know, would have for themselves.
Mm. I think too, on the content creation side, something that I've noticed is it becomes a waterfall effect. And what I mean is, content creator number one creates some content, it trickles out to content creator number two, and then number three and number four. And so the source of the information either gets diluted through time, or the source of the information at the beginning was incorrect and it was passed three, four, five times down, and people just take it for gospel that that must be true. And so I see that as, on the content creator side, something that I try to be very thoughtful of when I'm doing my episodes, because there is a lot of that that goes on, especially on the podcast or just the content side in general. YouTube podcast doesn't really matter. I think the other thing, going back to ice bath things, because that's something that I actually do, but I do it for a very important reason, and I think this is important to paint for the audience. It depends the reason you're doing something. For me personally, I do ice baths for the difficulty in the morning, not so much the health implication. It's the ability to conquer the mind, and then that becomes the reason why I do them. And so again, going back to the binary conversation that we had at the opening of this interview, I think it's important for people to realize that it's just not good or bad all the time. It's really, what's the intention? What's the reason that you want to do this thing beyond the research and everything else, right? Because I think as a consumer, that's also an important aspect as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Context. And this is all the nuance, right? Context and intention matter. Right. If you talk to the guy who runs the research at the U.S. Olympic Training Center, he'll very explicitly say the research is actually crystal clear that ice baths impair muscular hypertrophy in terms of developing muscle. And so it's not recommended to do it on a regular basis. It actually impairs strength and muscle gains. So you don't want to do it as an athlete. The exception for that is when they have athletes that are essentially injured or highly inflamed from doing very, very intense exercise, and they still need to go compete because they're a professional athlete the next day, then yeah, there are professional athletes who do ice baths, but they're not Joe Schmo, you and me. they're doing it because they're, you know, they have to make a living on it. If they don't show up for work, you know, they're in trouble. And so it's literally an extreme use case thing and not to be used, in fact, on a regular basis. But people miss that subtlety, that context. It makes sense. For the average consumer, it doesn't. And then for you, you're also bringing up an interesting thing, which is there may be completely psychological, not physiological reasons that you want to increase. It's almost like an exposure therapy to difficult things. Although I will take a little bit of a contrarian view. I've heard that argument. I do believe it can work for some people, but I also think it's a little bit of a simulacrum, in the sense that I think life is hard enough. And if you're doing challenging things, you should cut your teeth on the things that are actually difficult. The experience that I have as a psychologist is that willpower doesn't tend to domain transfer very well. And I have this experience with clients. They can be phenomenal about working out 5-6 days a week. They're very disciplined. It does not translate to studying or doing their work. And so the practice that you get from discipline in one area, for some reason, just doesn't generalize very well, contrary to most people's opinion, because I think our brain is so contextual, and the things that make, for instance, sitting down and focusing difficult may not apply to the incredible dopamine rush that you get when you do an ice bath or do a very hard lifting exercise, right? For someone who's ADHD, I would say exercise and ice baths are great. They're almost like a Adderall-like behavioral stimulant. But get them to sit down in a room and focus for 4 hours straight doing something that's boring for them is 100 times harder. And because it doesn't have the same dopaminergic stimulation, it's not going to translate very well. So just something to watch out for, in the sense that I've heard this argument a lot. So why do people do ultra marathons? It's like, I'm training my brain to do hard things. I get it. Like if it works for you, then awesome. Go continue to do it. But I think a lot of these things, I think, are actually, in my opinion, sometimes procrastination for people. And they think they're training or preparing in some general training. It's like psychological, mental fitness way, when if you want to get good at something, do the thing that you're trying to do, for the most part.
Yeah, I think that that's a wonderful point. And again, I think it's so dependent on the individual. For me, discipline is not very difficult, I would say, but you're 100% correct that I think a lot of us choose busy work, right? We choose something that we feel makes us feel or look or feel productive, when in reality, those are just delayers from that thing that we actually need to do, the real big or hard task that we haven't wanted to do. So then we pick up other things that we think will make us look productive or feel productive at the end of the day, which really isn't what's moving us forward in life. And I think that's important to understand.
Yeah, I think I tweeted about this 20-something LinkedIn influencer was talking about their morning routine that was so long and extensive, they didn't start work till 1 o'clock. And I was like, you got to be friggin' kidding me. Like, what is this? You know, like, it's almost like jump the shark in terms of how ridiculous these morning routines have become. To the point that, like, my favorite morning routine I've ever read of anyone was like, I take a shit in the morning and I start work. And I was like, God bless that person, because that sounds a lot healthier to me. That's why I tweeted. I was like, my thesis around morning routines, because people ask me all the time, what's the best morning routine? And I almost feel like there's this like mythology around it, that if only I hone the perfect morning routine, then all of my productivity will be optimal. My life will become settled in and I will bring order to chaos in my life. Right? It's strange, right? It's almost this like ritualistic magic that people have imparted on it. And my thesis is, I think the people who don't have any morning routine, they should actually have a morning routine, right? Because those people are disorganized, unconscientious, and they need a little stability and routine in their life. If you've ever raised children, they benefit from routine. They like the stability. I know I'm eating at this time, right? It soothes, right? And I think adults are just grown children anyway. Now, ironically, a lot of the people that I surround myself with, that are entrepreneurs, investors, people like you and me, who are obsessed about morning routines, I actually think you should not have a morning routine at all, because sometimes the poison is the antidote. And this is going back to your question about the Brian Johnsons of the world. People who are perfectionistic by nature or disposition take it too far, right? They're the people who are like, now I got to spend an hour doing my breathing and my meditation, and I got to shine my light in my eyes, and I got to drink my thing, and not 90 minutes, you know? And then it's like, what are you doing? Well, first of all, you're a neurotic mess. Your wife or girlfriend is driven crazy by your nuttiness, impacting your relationships, and you're not starting your fucking work, right, on time, which is just go and do the damn thing, as we were talking about. So they need the opposite. They need to take a shit and go to work, basically, as soon as possible. So that's the individualization that I'm talking about. Someone who is anxious and perfectionistic needs as little as possible. Someone who is disorganized and unconscientious needs more. And so that's why you have to understand the person and where you're coming from. The problem is, a lot of these influencers are smart, wealthy people with obsessive compulsive personality disorder. Clearly, and I'm a clinical psychologist, and this is my point of view, that I think a lot of these folks who are, you know, entrepreneurs or sometimes, you know, MDs or PhDs miss. They don't have any background in psychology. They don't honestly realize how neurotic, quite frankly, that they are. And they're almost creating, just like we talk about mass hysteria, I think there is literally a spread of neuroticism that's happening from these influencers, because they're like, oh, they're celebrities. They're smart. They know what they're doing. And so their obsessive compulsive morning routines, they're like, well, that's what the doctor is saying to do. I should adopt that too. And it's almost spreading neuroticism amongst the educated elite of American society. I can't tell you how many people listen to certain podcasts, and that has become their source of health information and their health routines. But I'm like, this person is very, very neurotic, and you shouldn't use that as a role model. Some of these influencers have literally been hospitalized for their psychiatric conditions. I'm not going to name names, but they're people that you listen to. And I'm not sure that they're great models for mental health. And so for me, especially working with high achieving clients in my private practice, I pretty much work with CEOs and VCs, you know, perfectionism is a scourge, and you have to be very careful about overdoing it on the perfectionistic side, because it's great for work. Being a perfectionist is, generally speaking, going to make you successful. But in your personal life, in terms of your romantic relationships and in terms of your health, I see people way overdoing it. We have literally clients in our community, because of their marathon and triathlon training, have damaged their knees, have gotten surgeries, literally harming their physical body because they cannot let go of this obsessive need to overtrain, quite frankly. Now, that doesn't apply for most people. Most Americans are overweight or obese and need to do anything, honestly, to get moving. But we see the extreme so often that, you know, I think getting people back to some reasonable, moderate sense of center is really, really important. And so I think people fail to appreciate, like, what is the point of all this? I actually don't think it is to live forever. I am very anti-longevity. Don't get me wrong. I want to live as long as humanly possible. But I think quality of life, honestly, trumps quantity of life. And the thing that the Brian Johnsons of the world miss is, honestly, a lot of their obsessive perfectionistic behavior is an avoidance of the fear of death. As a psychologist, it's crystal clear. Like, we are all going to die, you and me. And this is a stark, uncomfortable reality. And of course, I don't want to accelerate that in a premature fashion, but we need to come to terms and make peace with that, right? And the obsessive, like, I want to live to 180 and inject things in places that don't need to be injected. And ironically, I think they're going to go so far that I literally bet Brian $1 million that he's going to die, you know, sooner than that random guy. There was a guy in the Middle East who didn't take a shower for 50 years and he died at like 94.
I heard of this. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, you're not going to outlive this guy, because, you know, the sad reality is, like, genetics are probably the biggest factor. And until we're doing gene editing, you're not going to live longer.
Right.
Second, the one thing that's actually common amongst centenarians is they're kind of chill. You know what I mean? They don't get super stressed out. It's not their magical diet, which is ironically the antithesis of all of these influencers. They're neurotic, anxious people who are not chill. They have no chill. And so if you're going to do anything to improve your health, I would say manage your stress levels by not being a neurotic, compulsive mess. So, you know, that's the thing I think people miss, that everyone wants a magic pill. It's like, it's almost endemic to American society. And my company sells magic pills because we give people what they want, to obviously in an ethical and responsible way. But at the same time, we balance that and saying, look, this is not going to, it's not a panacea. It's not going to cure anything. Sure, we can increase your testosterone, for instance, which will make you feel better, improve your energy and mood. But is it going to give you, no pill will give you a rich, meaningful, and fulfilling life, right? That primarily comes from the quality of your relationships, which, if you're sleeping by yourself, there's a funny Twitter account that, like, basically shares the protocols of one of these famous influencers. And, you know, they slotted like 15 minutes for having sex with under red light therapy and then going to bed. And I was like, this is the best protocol to accelerate a divorce. If you're giving your 15 minutes of your time and only 15 minutes in this slot under this light. And I was just like, Jesus, like, what happened to spontaneity and romance and just, I don't know, like, living your life a little bit. So,
and did they say sleeping in separate beds too, right?
And sleeping in separate beds. Yes. Now, I was just like, way to get your wife to hate you. You know, I was like, probably that's empirically true. You probably do have better sleep quality in separate beds, but you gotta balance and look at the big picture. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I think everything really in life just comes down to balance, right? Because I have talked to a ton of people that have a laundry list of a morning routine, right? I have a morning routine, but it doesn't take me until one, right? It takes me an hour and I get multiple things done within that hour. Like dopamine fasting, no cell phones, you know, doing some reading, doing my journal, simple stuff like that. But something that I've noticed in talking to some people through my coaching program is that some people that have morning or evening routines, when they don't achieve that morning routine and hit check all of those boxes, it then is this cascading negative event for the rest of the day for them. So it's this irony too there that I see with a lot of individuals with morning routines or evening routines as well.
Yeah, you bring up a great point. And there's an interesting physiological and psychological parallel. So, you know, in the dietary community, there's a concept of metabolic flexibility, right? So when you talk to people who are vegan or carnivore, they're so fastidious about their diets that if they're only eating meat and they eat a plant, they're like, oh, I get bloated and I feel terrible. I can't touch a carbohydrate. I'm going to die if I'm keto. And same thing, the plant-based people, they feel like they're going to get nauseous if they touch a lick a piece of bacon. And I'm like, that doesn't sound healthy or flexible at all. Like generally, it's fine to have a particular dietary perspective, right? I'm generally animal-based personally, right? I think I follow sort of ancestral diets. But like if plants like completely kill you and throw you off, then you don't really have real metabolic flexibility, right? We are omnivores. We're designed to like eat anything in our environment to survive. You know what I mean? Our bodies are designed to be flexible, which is whatever fuel is around you, that's what you're going to live off of. Now, in the presence of abundance, you probably want to eat more protein, more plant-based, more meat, because that is preferred fuel. But yeah, man, our ancestors ate a lot of fucking potatoes too, because it was better than being in a famine. And so we can eat whatever. That same principle applies psychologically to your point as well, in that it's great if you have a routine. You know, I think, like I said, stability and structure are soothing on a psychological basis. But the moment that you're thrown off, what if you're traveling? You can't go to your favorite gym, or you're not doing your little ice blended bulletproof coffee. Then that's where the neuroticism kicks in and says, oh, now I'm not optimal, and everything gets thrown off, right? So what's the real issue there? It's a lack of what we call psychological flexibility. This is a core principle in ACT. And this is a really interesting thing. ACT is acceptance and commitment therapy. It's a type of psychotherapy that I teach at UCSF Medical School to the psychiatry residents, and I practice in my own practice. And it's a very interesting philosophy because it's a mindfulness and values-based therapy. And as opposed to like a CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, where someone might come in and say, hey, doc, I have anxiety. It's an 8 out of 10. Can you make it go down and provide me with symptomatic relief? In ACT, they would say, well, no, I don't think anxiety is the problem. It's actually the avoidance of anxiety that's the problem, right? All the things, your neurotic routines that you're doing, which is actually an avoidance of anxiety, or all this longevity things that you're doing because it's an avoidance of the fear of death, as I've talked about. It's anxiety is actually not necessarily problematic. It's all the weird shit that we do to avoid sitting with it and making peace with it. So the patients that I'm most worried about are not the people who are anxious or even sometimes depressed. You go through grief and loss in your life. Sadness is not intrinsically a pathological emotion. It's when it becomes chronic and problematic that it's an emotion. The people that I worry the most about are the people who are most psychologically inflexible. And so because you don't adapt, right? You can't, if your routine is thrown off, to your point, just roll with the punches and say, you know what? Good enough, right? Or how can I adjust and flex? Because not only do they become obsessive about their routines, but when it gets thrown off, there's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So let's use an example. Bedtime routines are something I actually advocate for, because having a bedtime routine signals to your brain it's time to wind down and go to sleep. And so it's useful to have a ritual, and one that is repetitive, because your brain associates, hey, if I drink my chamomile tea and I read my book, it's time to slow down and go off to bed. And it's essentially classical conditioning, right? I'm associating the stimuli with a response, which is to relax my body, shift from sympathetic to a parasympathetic rest and digest state so I can fall asleep. Now, what happens if you're traveling and you don't have your chamomile tea, you forgot your book? Now I can't sleep, because I'm telling myself, oh, without the routine, I am off. And it's the anxiety about it that's actually causing the insomnia, right? Versus if you're not neurotic about it, you're like, oh, well, you know, I don't have it. I don't know. I'll read something else. Or maybe I'll just go for a walk and it'll be okay, right? If you can literally tell yourself that from your higher sense of self almost, right? Self-soothing, self-parenting, if you will, then it's fine. And you can be psychologically flexible and you can fall asleep just fine, right? And so you don't want to essentially create dependence. In psychology, we call these safety signals, right? There's people who are like, I can't leave the house without my whatever it is, pepper spray, Xanax or whatever. And if I don't, now I'm anxious because I've literally created a psychological dependence on it. So all I'm saying is the routines and the behaviors are not inherently problematic. It's the psychological dependence on them and the inflexibility around them that's actually the problem.
you may already know about my private coaching program, which offers tremendous benefits. However, there's another approach worth exploring: group coaching. This type of coaching emphasizes systems thinking, fostering skills in reflection, reframing, questioning, problem solving, and time management, all on top of encouraging relationship building and dismantling internal silos. Well, I'm thrilled to introduce my group coaching program, where we'll meet twice a month, every first and third Friday, for 45-minute video sessions. Prior to each session, I'll present a key theme and a thought-provoking question of the week. During our sessions, I'll share insights, hacks, and methods related to the week's topic, fostering a free-flow conversation where questions and personal experiences are welcomed. After each session, you'll receive engaging assignments linked to the theme. These assignments will be shared on our group coaching Discord channel, allowing everyone to provide feedback and engage in a dynamic, interactive experience. Join me for a coaching experience that blends strategic insight and meaningful connections by clicking the link in the show notes. I'm excited to announce that I've teamed up with Supercast to create a more robust and easy-to-access premium membership platform for listeners of this podcast, which will replace my current paid subscriber program through Spotify. Starting in January 2024, by subscribing to the Motivated Mind Plus, you will get access to a range of exciting perks, including access to 2 exclusive bonus episodes every month across all platforms now, ad-free listening across all platforms and new episodes, access to my members-only Discord channel, and exclusive discounts on my courses and premium newsletter subscription on Substack. All of this is available to you for only $5.99 a month. And don't worry, you can still listen to my regular 2 episodes per week for free forever. This transition will enable me to offer a wider range of features and benefits, all aimed at enhancing your engagement with my content, including being able to now access bonus episodes across Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcast platforms. Most importantly, your subscription directly supports the podcast and the content I create by making future shows possible. Click the link in the show notes to subscribe today.
What do you think are, switching gears a little bit here, what do you think are some of the basics that we've gotten away from? So we've been talking about a lot of the complexity that's been thrown out there from the Brian Johnsons of the world. What are some of, if you're sitting down with anybody, you're making a video out to the world, you say, guys, these are literally the 3 to 4 things that you need to focus on. Forget about red light therapy. Forget about all of these other things. Just focus on the basics. Because for me personally, 2 things. I've never felt healthier than I felt at 33 right now. Number one, prioritizing my sleep. I've had a couple of sleep experts on. It has been a game changer for me. Number two, strength training. I do it 3 times a week for 45 minutes to around 1 hour and 10. And I have never felt so good. And I think there's definitely this complexity bias where it's like, well, it can't be that simple, right? It has to be more complex. The simple answer can't be the answer. What we were discussing earlier, what are some of the basics? If you say, just focus on the basics, these 3, 4, 5 things, that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. I think some people can start to do the more advanced stuff. I would say, look, if you're a professional athlete or someone that is monetizing your body, then sure, you can start to get into the advanced biohacking. That doesn't apply to 99% of people, right? So the majority of people actually should really focus on the basics. So what I call the 5 foundational health behaviors are sleep, nutrition, exercise, focus, and intimacy. Most people don't actually mention the last 2. Everyone talks about diet, exercise, and sleep, but I actually think focus and intimacy are really critical. And if I had to, it's hard to say one is more important than the other, but I actually make perhaps a contrarian view that focus is the most important health behavior, which is why I popularized dopamine fasting, which you mentioned at the earlier. Because if you don't have focus, you don't know how to prioritize your time and where to put your energy to focus on the other four things. And so if your life is a mess and you don't have, you're not creating the time to, for instance, do your three times a week of strength training, then all is lost. So the first thing that I think people have to do is make sure that they're treating their attention as sacred. And this is the interesting thing. If we were treating our, you know, dopaminergic stimuli like a drug, like imagine if you had a little vape, you know, vapes are really popular these days for people who are using nicotine or other drugs, and you were sucking this in 100 times a day. And you were an outsider and you saw your friend just sucking on this vape 100 plus times a day. You'd be like, this person is addicted, right? This is a compulsive thing that they're kind of dependent on. And they also look a little silly sucking into this little thing like a kid. And I'm worried about this person because what if they didn't have it? We basically do that with our smartphones. You can open up your iPhone app and the number of pickups per day are often 100 plus. But we don't treat it like a drug. Now, maybe it's not as strong as a drug in that there isn't physiological withdrawal like there is with classical addiction that you see with substances, but it is absolutely constantly eliciting a dopaminergic response, and it steals focus. And people underappreciate how much distraction makes it difficult to shift attention back to the point of focus, which is why I'm not anti-social media use. I obviously use it professionally in my own company, but I promote sort of dopamine feasting in the sense of use it for a scheduled time block, like do all your messages during that hour rather than doing 100 times throughout the day. I don't mind if you do it once, but you do it with a concentrated block. And then the rest of the time, dopamine fast and do the things that are actually important, because then you're not constantly stealing your attention back and forth and you can finally focus and make time. There was a great study that I always cite where they had college students just cut out Facebook for 2 weeks. And they interestingly found that they saved 13.3 hours, I believe, per week of time they just gained back. And interestingly, they didn't tell them what to do with that time. They started exercising. They started cooking. They started doing their hobbies. All the things, because everyone is so busy. Everyone's like, I have no free time. And it's true, because all of the, you know, free time that we did have is sucked up by often the device use. You go to any lobby in any doctor's office, people are on their phones. No one is bored anymore, because it's almost like filler. It's sand that kind of falls in around the stones. And so I would say start with focus, and whatever is distracting you, minimize it or contain it as much as possible so that you have the time and the attention to do all the other health behaviors. So that's first and foremost. I have a great protocol. You can Google dopamine fasting 2.0 if you want to read more about that. Number two, I agree with you. Sleep is king. Ironically, you can't have focus when you're sleep deprived. One night of sleep deprivation, I did my doctorate at UCLA for the Cousins Center for Psychoneuroimmunology, elicits a inflammatory response. And so even one night is acutely essentially harmful. And we know that it messes with your ghrelin and your leptin hormones. And so your appetite becomes dysregulated. So if you're trying to control your diet, I always tell people the best way if you're trying to lose weight is to fix your sleep first and foremost, because you cannot regulate your appetite if you're not sleeping at least 7 to 9 hours a night. So figure out, and I have, you know, you can look up I have Twitter threads on sleep optimization, et cetera. Figure out how to optimize your sleep so that you're getting 7 to 9 hours of quality sleep per night, because that's the foundation. Third, I agree with you. Exercise, especially for psychological health, is paramount. There's a good large-scale meta-analytical studies showing it helps. It's not a replacement for therapy. There's too many Twitter accounts saying, oh, just go to the gym and you don't need to ever do that. For more complex issues, you need a therapist. And it's different. It's a relationship. There's no amount of lifting a heavy rock that's going to figure out what you should do with your girlfriend. You know what I mean? Sure, it'll help regulate your mood, but it's like a foundational thing. I generally agree with you. Every other day, strength training, paramount. Walk about 8,000 steps a day, according to the research literature. And ideally, if you're healthy, do some sort of sprinting. Like, man is born to run. And so whether it's soccer or basketball or just doing some a couple sprints, it's a very sad statistic that 90% of people over the age of 30 will never sprint ever again in their life, which is sad. And I think especially in terms of maintaining our mobility as we age, you see kids love to run around. They run everywhere. So we should do that at some point. So low, medium, and high intensity exercise, essentially, you need to have a little bit of both. So exercise is the second one. Third, nutrition is obviously king. The overwhelming majority of the ability to maintain your weight comes from nutrition, not exercise. Exercise is really, the research shows, important for weight maintenance. It helps you keep the weight off, but exercise does not help you lose weight. There are plenty of people like Oprah who've trained to run a marathon. They're still overweight because what happens is exercise stimulates your appetite. You're going to eat basically all the calories that you burn. And the best thing, there's so many diet debates, as I mentioned, and really the behavioral psychological literature is very clear. The best diet is the one that you're willing to do and stick to long-term, because compliance actually trumps every single particular type of diet, low fat, low carb, blah, blah, blah. They all work, actually. The thing that's the most effective predictor is how compliant are you to that diet. The better you stick with it, the better the outcome. So that's why it's like, look, I could tell you what I think is the best diet, but if you're unwilling to do it, then there's no point. And if you're not able to stick with it for whatever reason, again, there's no point. So be realistic. And I think that's true for exercise. What are you willing to do realistically, literally for the rest of your life? Create that and stick to it. Now, the one thing that we are able to agree on is eating unprocessed food. Majority of the nutritional problems that we have come from the use of processed and ultra processed food. In fact, 66% of American dietary calories come from ultra processed food. And these are foods that you have a nutritional label, a bunch of chemicals that you don't even know what the hell they are, or can't even pronounce. So you want to minimize that. I ideally tell you real food is basically doesn't have any nutritional label, right? Think about it. Meat, vegetables, fruit. There's no nutritional label. There's one ingredient. It's a banana. You know what it is. You don't need a label to explain it. You don't need a dietary, explanation of what hidden, fibers they've stuck in there. If you have your majority of your food be from single foods that have no nutritional label, you're going to do it right. Now, obviously, you can have a little bit of minimally processed foods, which are things like yogurt, right? It's only like two ingredients. It's like milk and bacterial culture. You know what it is. You can theoretically make it at home. You can't make a Cheeto at home. That thing is like made in some factory. And it's literally designed by food scientists. There's a great article called The Science of Junk Food in the New York Times. They interviewed food scientists and they literally like test and figure out how to make a Cheeto melt in your mouth fast enough that you don't even notice the calories. They're designer drugs. And so ultra processed food should be considered, just like these digital devices I was saying, as designer drugs. And you should minimize your use of them because they're going to make you fat. So that's the third thing. So we talked about focus. We talked about sleep. We talked about exercise. We talked about diet. And then the last one is intimacy. And people also fail to appreciate that. If you actually look at the long-term, the Harvard 75-year studies of what makes people satisfied and fulfilled, it comes down to the quality of their relationships. That's the other thing that these longevity fools fail to appreciate. To your point, if you're sleeping alone, what kind of intimacy do you have whether a physical basis or even an emotional basis? Got to cuddle. I was like, I'm pretty sure cuddling is good for your health. Oxytocin release. I can cite you the studies, but I can just anecdotally tell you and talk to anyone. Like, human beings are in need of touch. That's also, by the way, something that men fail to appreciate too. I mean, obviously we appreciate sex, but hug, intimacy, holding hands, they're incredibly soothing. And if you almost revert back a little bit to your childhood, when you were a boy and you weren't so machismo about, I don't need to be touched. Boys love to be touched. They love affection. They love to be hugged. They love to play. They even play, they touch each other. We're very hands-on. And there's an incredible epidemic of loneliness amongst men, who I think a third of men have had zero physical intimacy in the last year, which is remarkable. But even then, like, ask how many men are actually touched. They've even gotten a hug, right? A pat on the back. All these things are really paramount, I think, to our health. And not only to mention that, but the emotional intimacy, and that guys generally don't open up with their emotions. Ask people, do you have someone in your life that you can tell the hard things to, the deepest, darkest secrets? I would say a good proportion of men have no one in their life that they can truly be vulnerable with. Sure, it could be a therapist, but it could be a family member, it could be a friend, it could be a loved one. We don't have that. And I think it's paramount to have someone that you can be 100% authentic and real with. And so finding that person, being able to communicate with them and have conversations of depth with real emotional intimacy, kind of like what we're having now, make people feel connected in a real way. And I don't know if it'll make you live longer. There's probably some research on that, but it certainly will give you a richness to your life that I cannot quantify, but I know is very real.
Mm-hmm. man, this is a great subject to touch on. You know, I don't remember who said it, but maybe it was Scott Galloway. I can't remember during a speech, but he said, you know, I've told my kids it's not the career or getting into an industry that has an upward trajectory that's the biggest decision and best decision that you can make. It's who you choose to be with for the rest of your life that is the most important decision that you make. And my wife and I, something that we do, and I've said this on the podcast before, when we eat dinner as part of our dinner routine, if you will, there is no cell phones and we have to share a win or wins for the day. And I love the connection in that moment that we have. There are, I see these memes all the time where couples where it's like, oh, when you first start dating, you know, you cuddle and then you don't. I'm like, man, my wife and I have been not only dating for years, but then married. We always cuddle. And I don't get this kind of manly thing where guys feel like, you know, they're being vulnerable if they say these things. I'm like, I really don't give a shit, right? Unless you're paying my bills or taxes, you can't, I don't care what you say. It's not going to affect the way I think or live my life. So the intimacy is big. Our daughter's going to turn one on the 18th of this month. So we're new parents. And one of the things that, again, I don't remember who said this, but they said, you know, make sure that your child isn't the center of your world. And they broke it down for me. And I said, why is that? He said, because imagine if the child is the center of your world, then you lose the intimacy and the relationship that you have with your spouse. And then that child doesn't see what real love is. And then they grow up and are challenged in building relationships, whether it be intimate or not. And I think having a kid for us has even doubled down our intimacy in our relationship because of that child factor, having our daughter now. But switching gears off the intimacy, I want to go back to focus for a moment here. Oh, this focus. So Apple came out with those new Vision Pro headsets, and this has been littered all over social media everywhere, and I see people walking around with it in New York City and, you know, driving with it and all these other things. I literally said this to my wife last night, and I love technology, right? Again, down to balance. Is it not sad that we have this beautiful world around us, but now we're trying to create things to escape that world that we live in? And devices, I think you posted this on your Twitter because I was stalking your feed going back and back and back. It was like the early 2000s, there was no cell phones. Everybody was talking. People were engaging with each other. And that's really got to me lately. It's gotten to me, you know, you were saying in the doctor's office, everybody on their phone, people walking, bumping into each other or objects because they're not paying attention. It's sad to me that it's come down to that we're escaping and numbing and filling up all that white space that you were referring to earlier. We don't let our thoughts rise. We don't listen to our own emotions and feelings. And we grab something right away when we feel an ounce of being uncomfortable or bored. And being bored is a really good thing. And I just think these dopamine hits, these devices that have been highly optimized to rob us of attention, it's kind of gotten out of hand. It's really getting out of hand.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the movie Inception, I believe, when, yeah, you know, people were kind of like hooked up in a, you know, fantasy world or alternative reality. You know, I think a lot of movies and sci-fi essentially predict the future. And we're seeing that essentially with the Apple Vision Pro. I think it's an inevitable consequence, although it's an interesting reflection of our own society. It is sad. I agree with you. But why have we created a society where people want to escape in the first place, right? That's the real question. I remember watching this documentary on video game addicts, computer game addicts. You're playing like 12 hours a day sometimes. And I was like, why is it even controversial? This is an addiction. If someone's spending 12 hours a day, clearly that's coming to the detriment of all these health behaviors and their real life. But, you know, they were interviewing a psychologist in this documentary and they were saying, well, what does that say about society if people are choosing to essentially spend their life in another reality? They really do not like this reality. And is that their failure? Is it our failure as a society that we've made people so uncomfortable that millions, tens of millions of people would spend majority of their waking hours in a literally an alternative reality. So I think it's a sad condemnation of us in that, you know, for at least, I don't know, a quarter of people, they probably would prefer to live in an alternative reality. And what do we do about that? Now, look, I still at the same time, I think there's social responsibility, but there's individual responsibility as well. In that, you know, one of my hot takes on Twitter is I think in 20 years, we're going to consider scrolling as the new smoking. You know, back in 50 years ago, there was no stigma around smoking. In fact, there was doctors who smoked and they thought it was fine and great. Obviously, you know, we found out the consequences of that. And there's been a huge societal shift in the perception of that. I think it'll literally be the same with scrolling in that it's not going to disappear. People still smoke, you know, probably one in 10 people these days. But the majority of people don't. It's stigmatized. It reduces your dating prospects, blah, blah, blah. And so it's kind of a niche behavior. And I think it'll become the same with excessive social media use, pornography, online gambling, gaming, the stuff that's particularly addictive, I think we'll realize is just as harmful as anything else. It's not going to go away because honestly, they are enjoyable. Some of, you know, as we always say in pharmacology, the dose is the poison. None of these things are intrinsically terrible. But in excess, and if it comes at the cost of social or occupational impairment, then that's when it becomes problematic or a disorder, right? Obviously, playing video games, I played Nintendo as a kid, it was fine. But we also ran outside and played, and it wasn't so addictive. We didn't treat it like an addictive thing because it was counterbalanced by other things. But I think we'll realize the addictiveness of it. And that's why, like I was saying, I promoted dopamine fasting, the segmentation of these things so that it is not all-consuming and it doesn't become excess in our lives. And that's the individual responsibility to be like, all right, I got to really pay attention to like, what is the impact of this in my life? If I am exercising, sleeping, eating right, having good intimacy, then sure, I can play some video games on the side. It's not having a deleterious impact. But if I'm not working out and I don't feel, and I'm making excuses, I don't have time to cook, then maybe I do need to cut out some, you know, excess time in my life and make room for the things that are more foundational, obviously.
I love that. That's the mic drop here, Dr. Kim. I love that. So where can people follow you challenging this noise online, social media, and Maximus?
For sure. I'm semi-active on social media, much to my detriment, I would say. Look, I mean, I don't pretend to be perfect myself. I actually don't have a personal Instagram. I have a professional Instagram. And it was kind of funny. I avoided having a smartphone for a long time until I started my first company. Because I knew I was like, I'm going to be just as addicted as anyone else. But, you know, we launched a mobile app and I was like, I got to test it. And then I got suckered in just like all of us, you know, I'm just as human as everyone else. But I try to be mindful about it. And I try to, my rule of thumb is I try to produce more content than I consume. It's a good rule of thumb. And you know why it's a good rule of thumb? Because it's hard to produce content actually, right? It's time consuming, it's energy consuming, it's focus. And so it almost has a natural break or limitation. In that, I don't know how much you can produce. I can't do more than an hour a day. Otherwise, I get tired. But you can scroll and watch Netflix all day. It just auto, you know, keeps playing. And it's so good while you're watching Breaking Bad or some, you know, amazing content. You can clearly, the ratio between producing and consuming gets thrown off. So if you want to use that as a useful rule of thumb, do that. You can find me on social media. It's Dr. Cam RX on Twitter. It's Dr. Cam Maximus on Instagram. And then I want to give a shout out to our community. So what I actually did with Maximus, before we even started a company or even had a single product, I said, I just want to start a community for men. And the thesis around it is that self-improvement, I hate the term self-improvement, because it means you're doing it alone. And we were never meant to do anything alone. You know, and this is the isolation and loneliness that I was talking about, that's epidemic, especially during the pandemic, right? And I was like, you know, think about the kind of the male experience of becoming a boy into a man. Oftentimes in many countries or in time periods, you served in the military for 1 or 2 years at least. You went through a cohort together, or maybe you went to college, you were in a fraternity, you were placed in a group of similar peers and went through a difficult experience together that was formative in some way. And we've lost that for the most part. And that helps you grow together. And so I believe in mutual improvement. So we started a Discord community. You can join it for free. It's MaximusTribe.com/Discord. And my thesis is like, why does anyone need to be alone with the internet? There's about 5,000 guys in our community, and it's literally for mutual improvement. So we have protocols and people talk about that, but people talk about things that we don't sell at all. We have a channel about parenting, to your point. We have a channel about leveling up on your career. People share investment tips. People share and make memes, which are really funny, to spread just humor and joy and mirth in the world. You know, I think that's one of the things I love about Elon Musk. It's not that he's the richest man in the world. He's a meme lord, and he has a sense of humor, which is a great thing. You know, and I bet he's going to live longer, honestly, than some of these longevity people, because I don't know, being able to laugh at yourself is a good thing. So I think this community is really critical. Now, that's not a replacement for in-person friends and community. I do think you need a core, ideally handful of friends that are your true friends. But it is great. Like, you know, we as a people grew up in villages and tribes. We're tribal. I don't think that's ever going to be extracted from human nature. People talk about tribalism being a bad thing. I think it can be, obviously, if it's misled in some way. But I think the tribal nature of humanity is intrinsic. And so I think you can leverage it for good by creating essentially an online tribe. That's why your company is called Maximus, but we're called MaximusTribe.com, because that's the name of our community. And it brings people together. And it's great. You know, you have kids that are like 18. They're like, I don't know what to do with my life. Maybe I should become a software engineer. And there's a software engineer in my community who's like, let me mentor you. Let me teach you what you need to do. These are the courses that I would take. This is what I would study in college. And it's great to see that intergenerational mentorship of people giving back. We have a hedge fund manager who has three kids, and he's like, all right, here's how to invest your money if you're a young professional. And it's so awesome to be able to give and receive mentorship and feel connected. Now, it's not that same level of physical intimacy that we were talking about, the touching. That obviously you need to do in your personal life. But the emotional, mental stimulation and intimacy you can get from brotherhood, a bigger group and community that I think no matter where you are in the world can make people feel connected. And then lastly, I obviously have the company. I don't want to give, you know, plug it too much, but you can check us out at MaximusTribe.com. We do health and hormone optimization, including testosterone. But I'll tell you, I always tell people testosterone even of itself is not a panacea. We can help increase your mood and energy, but really it's up to you in terms of how you channel that energy in a way that's positive, that's pro-social, and that's productive. That's why you need psychology, community, of like, where do I channel that energy? Because if I go double people's testosterone and they go act like douchebags, I haven't done the world any good, right? But when you teach someone how to be a man and, you know, the social responsibilities of men to protect, to provide, to guide, whether it's their family, their community, and other people, that's the real mission of Maximus, in my opinion. And that's why we have a community, to help people kind of like, all right, what do I do with this, you know, this incredible life and blessing that we have here on Earth?
Love that. I love that. I super appreciate you giving your most valuable asset, like I said at the beginning, your time. This, I think the audience is going to find a ton of value in this episode, and I'm glad that it goes against the grain, right? Hopefully it'll challenge everybody's thinking and people will be a little more curious and skeptical of the information that's out there. And hopefully this episode is the start to that.
Thanks for listening to The Motivated Mind with your host, Scott Lynch. I hope you enjoyed our deep dive into decoding health narratives with Dr. Cam. If you did, share it, shout it out on social media, or drop a rating and review. Stay connected with me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Motivated Scott. Don't forget to join me every Monday and Thursday for new episodes. I love you all, and thanks so much for listening. The Motivated Mind is a Legacy Division.